Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Now, I am absolutely over the moon to be joined by one of my edu heroes this morning.
It's great to see where you've taken Naylor's Natters, and I'm excited to be on today. I honestly just say I'm a teacher, because I think it's a good test, you know. What's the endorphins you get through your run? What's the social capital you get from posting it on your socials and things like that? That's the benefits. But motivation has this other side, which is the cost. And cost is the effort you need to put in to get that reward. More important than learning intentions, I would actually say it's important that the teacher maps out in more detail what it is they want the students to know.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Research by the Seaside is back. Yep, you heard it right. Research Ed Blackpool returns for its third year, following enormously successful conferences in 2018 and 2019. Now, as you'll know, both of those conferences sold out pretty quickly, so book early to avoid disappointment. As always, expect for an exciting day packed full of research-informed practice from speakers from both primary and secondary backgrounds. The date for your diary, Saturday, 9th of July, 2022, and the location is South Shore Academy, St Anne's Road, Blackpool. That's Research at Blackpool 2022. Hope to see you there.
Naylor's Natter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book, ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them, and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Okay, good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to this week's Naylor's Natter. Now, I am absolutely over the moon to be joined by one of my edu heroes this morning. So, Ollie Lovell is joining us this morning, and we are going to be talking about his fantastic new book. And the book is Tools for Teachers, How to Teach, Lead, and Learn Like the World's Best Educators. And it's a John Catt book. Now, before I kind of give Ollie the chance to introduce himself, just a story and a bit of a thank you. So, those of you that have seen pre-copies of the Naylor's Natter book, shameless plug, we'll see that I have referenced Ollie quite early on, both for the ERRR podcast and for the fact that he was so generous with his comments and helping out with us. Because when we started off, listener, as you will know, we weren't exactly at the cutting edge of audio technology. We had an iPhone propped up into an iPad, recorded straight into voice notes and whacked out onto Anchor straight out, and the sound was abysmal. It was a shame because of the quality people that we had on, and Ollie was kind enough to get in touch and say, you know, what kind of software are you using? You might want to look at this. You might want to tweak that. So for the ERRR, for keeping me going through, you know, lockdowns, commutes, gym sessions, and for the sound advice, thank you so much, Ollie, and a formal welcome to Naylor's Natter.
Thanks, Phil. Thanks for the generous intro. And it's great to see where you've taken Naylor's Natters, and I'm excited to be on today.
Thank you very much. Right, so I'm going to steal one of your questions. I know you don't use it all the time now, but you did originally start with questions about this. So If you were to introduce yourself at a dinner party, how would you introduce yourself? And can you tell listeners a little bit about your career to this point?
Sure. I honestly just say I'm a teacher, because I think it's a good test. You know, I think if you're chatting with someone who's like a genuinely nice person and you say you're a teacher, they'll still keep talking to you. But if you're talking to a bit of a snob and you say you're a teacher, then they'll stop talking to you. So I usually start with I'm a teacher. And then if the conversation goes on for a bit longer, generally it might end up that we end up talking about podcasts or things like that. And it might come up that I have a podcast or that I've written a few books or that I, you know, really enjoy working with teachers to improve their practice and things like that. In terms of career to date, yeah, I mean, uncomfortable on the other side of the mic, Phil. This is all very interesting. Yeah. In terms of my career to date, I've been a teacher in – I was a teacher in the public system here in Australia for 5 years. I've now been in a private school for 2 years. Before that, I was working at a university as a kind of relief lecturer and tutor. And, I started the ERRR podcast about a bit over – getting close to 6 years ago now, actually. And it's been an absolute joy to interview world leaders in education every month. And that's a brief overview.
No, thank you. And, you know, obviously listeners are going to be familiar with ERRR, and obviously we can signpost to the episodes in the show notes as well. So obviously you've written this book, as I said before, so it's Tools for Teachers. And I was a very fortunate listener to have a pre-copy of this to go through. And I tell you what, listen, this is, if you're going to buy one book this year, and this, you know, obviously I don't want to do shameless plugs for me, but if you're going to buy one educational book as a teacher for the summer here to refine your practice and get yourself ready for the next year, this is definitely the book to go out and get. So tell us, Ollie, how you went about, because I know from a much smaller range of interviews over a less period of time, how difficult it is to kind of synthesize, bring together the collective wisdom of people that you've spoken to. So how did the book come about, and how, what was the process like in terms of pulling all of that content from 6 years of ERRR into this book?
Thanks, Phil. And thanks for that very enthusiastic plug. It's always, you know, when you write a book, it's always a bit, you're uncertain as to whether it's hit the mark or if it's going to be valuable to people, because you're so close to it yourself generally. So it's really nice to hear that you've got so much out of it. In terms of how it came together, please excuse me, just getting over COVID actually right now. That's my voice a bit weird, and there may be a few coughs throughout the podcast. But in terms of bringing it together, it was actually originally meant to be a book that summarized the first 3 years of the ERRR podcast, because there was already so many great insights from all the people and educational leaders that I'd interviewed. But as it turned out, I got the offer to write Cognitive Load Theory in Action, and then I just couldn't quite manage to get Tools for Teachers together in a way that I was happy with. The version that you hold in your hands, or that you got the preprint copy of, Phil, is actually my fifth attempt at writing this book. So I definitely didn't find it easy, given that there was only one attempt at the Cognitive Load Theory book. And I end up throwing over 100,000 words in writing Tools for Teachers, because I just didn't feel like I could get it right the first four times. But in terms of the general approach, I just went back and I listened to every episode of the ERRR podcast back, and I made notes as I went. When I got to about the 35th episode or something, it got a little bit easier, because I did start doing summaries for patrons. And then basically all I did was, I was like a bowerbird. I just picked all the best things that I liked, and I got them into a really massive Word document. It's actually in a software called Obsidian, which is a really good software for moving ideas around and things like that. And I just collected them. And then I just tried to work out where, if they naturally fell into kind of categories. And as it happened, I managed to kind of put them into categories. And then I had to think, okay, well, how do these ideas relate to each other, which people will see in the kind of chapter maps. I worked out how to relate them together. And then after I relayed them together, I had to put them into kind of a cohesive narrative. It was essentially collect good ideas, put them in buckets, string them along, or relate them and then string them along a narrative, which sounds, you know, pretty simple in hindsight, but there's a lot of blood, sweat, and tears went into that process.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can echo that in terms of trying to do something nowhere near on the scale to the level that you've done this, but trying to pull together that amount of content and try and, like you said, distill that collective wisdom into chapters. And you very much have done that. And that's what we're going to do now, Ollie. We're going to get into the chapters, if that's okay.
Sure.
So we get into chapter one and look at explicit instruction. So for the listener, what have you kind of gleaned that are the three phases of direct instruction?
Yeah, so I've kind of pulled explicit instruction under three headings. And I tried to do this in most of the chapters. I tried to kind of boil things down to under three categories, because I feel like three is a really a great number it kind of makes things neat and it's memorable. Once you start getting more than three, it starts to get a bit hard to remember and hard to act on. So I've basically broken it down to say that explicit instruction has three key phases. The first is plan. The second is instruct. And the third is check for understanding. And then each of them can be broken down further. So planning can be thought of planning the participation. How do you want students to participate within the class? And planning the content. What do we actually want them to learn? Instruction is primarily thought of as the I do, we do, you do kind of sequence. And check for understanding. You know, we can ask questions to check for understanding. We can observe our students to check for understanding. And then once we've done that, it's valuable to provide feedback and adapt their instruction.
Thank you very much. So in terms of, you know, thinking about leaders and teachers, how important is it to plan the explicit knowledge that you're going to be putting into the content of each and every lesson?
Yeah, I was interested in this question, Phil, because you said, how important is it for leaders to plan? Do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think it's probably just a typo. I'm going to be honest. The listener of Nails Natter will get used to the fact that, you know, this sounded like a really intelligent question, but actually it's probably just a typo. So I think I was looking for really how it went for the teachers to plan the explicit content knowledge for each lesson.
Okay, got it. When I work with new teachers or graduate teachers or teachers that I'm coaching and things like that, I always say during the planning process, there's two things you need to be really clear about. The first is, what are students going to know, be able to do, say, make, or write by the end of this lesson that they couldn't do at the start? And the second question is, how do you know, or how will you know? And so in terms of that first one, that's what we're referring to in terms of the planning, the explicit knowledge. If we go into the room without a high level of clarity about what we want our students to take away from the lesson, that really diminishes the probability of us being able to convey that information to students. And it also diminishes our ability to check for understanding whether we've been successful or not. So that's why I'd say it's really key to really plan explicitly what you want students to know. In addition to that, I could probably add that once we're clear for ourselves about what we want our students to know, it's going to improve the clarity of our explanations because we know what we're trying to convey, and that removes one variable in terms of a lack of clarity and makes it easier to convey that to students.
Brilliant, thank you. And thank you for adapting on the off the cuff there to my poor question. So apologies, listener, for that one. Right, if we move into learning intentions. Now, in terms of, I listened to lots of episodes where you've talked in detail about learning intentions. And I think about my own practice, Holly, in terms of, you know, being back in the classroom. So, you know, listeners will be sick of me talking about the last 2 years and, you know, getting a promotion to deputy head and then doing a little bit of teaching. But then the pandemic and the just kind of partial closures kind of resulted in more logistical, organizational aspects of the role rather than necessarily the classroom teaching. But I felt as if it was important to get back into the classroom to be somebody who's, you know, leaders in school. It's important that they should teach. And one of the sections that I've talked about in the Nailers Natter book is about, you know, I have a feeling that all teachers should teach, including the head teacher, you know, because that's what they came into job for in the first place. The reason I'm asking that question is that, you know, I've had a kind of checkered history with learning intentions and been, when I was an advanced skills teacher, which was a kind of thing over here about 10, 15 years ago, and I spent hours and hours working with local authority advisors and experts crafting learning intentions really carefully on the wording and the taxonomy and the kind of knowledge behind all of those. And then it's still been very much part of the lessons, but it's almost kind of paid cursory attention to as the start of a lesson, right? These are the things we're going to be looking at today, and then kind of revisiting a little bit at the end. So just tell us a little bit, because you've gone into quite a lot of detail with the conversations that you've had about this, that should instruction always begin with a learning intention, and how important are learning intentions in kind of that learning journey?
Yeah, it's a great question, because they are a topic of heated discussion in many schools, I know. The main thing I've taken away from my conversations over the years about learning intentions is the purpose of them drives to the heart of essentially my answer to the previous question, which is teachers need to be really clear about what it is they want students to take away from the lesson. This is assuming we're using an explicit instruction approach, of course. So that's the importance. That's kind of the grounding of a learning intention. Whether or not it's communicated to students at the start, whether or not students write it in their books, and so on and so forth, really depends upon what the learning intention is. Because some learning intentions better suit themselves to being communicated at the start, and some better suit perhaps better suited to being introduced partway through the lesson. More important than learning intentions, I would actually say it's important that the teacher maps out in more detail what it is they want the students to know. So rather than, rather than spending heaps of time getting the exact perfect wording for what the intention is, I'd rather teachers spend a lot more time thinking about what exactly is the fact or the relationship or the formula or the process that students are going to learn within the lesson. Then, you know, you don't actually have to be as specific about the learning intention statement because you're just being much more explicit about the knowledge you're hoping that students leave the class with. The final thing I'll say on this is that I think a real danger of focusing on a learning intention is that we may do it for a single lesson, whereas it's more important for us to look at, as I mentioned, that knowledge, but not just the knowledge for a single lesson, actually the sequence of knowledge through a set of lessons over a term, over a year, and over multiple years to ensure that we're really giving students exposure to the key information that it's important for them to be aware of, but also giving them multiple exposures to it over time and deepening our coverage of the content over time, so we're repeating it enough that they're going to remember it and it's going to stick in their long-term memories, but also that it's going to be a rich learning experience for them.
Great answer, Ollie. Thank you. And it's you're absolutely right when you talk about that. I mean, it did become one of these potential lethal mutations that I know you've spoken to Dylan William about, that, you know, it was like, right, well, we have to focus on this, so we're going to spend hours and hours and hours crafting this, but actually forget about the knowledge that sits behind that. Forget about the actual, you know, delivery in the classroom and the instruction, and just spend, you know, lots and lots of time obsessing about this because this was something that we could easily measure as people that were looking to kind of look at the quality of teaching. Mm-hmm. So yes, you've got that. It's moved through Bloom's taxonomy, I think it was at the time. And then, oh, tick, you've completed that. But actually what you're talking about there is much more sustained over time and thinking about the knowledge behind that whole sequence of learning.
Mm. Yep, great point.
Okay, right. So this is another one. So, I mean, this is great CPD for me, by the way, Ollie, when this is the reason that I did the podcast in the first place is, you know, about hopefully I can improve my practice. And then, like I said to you on the previous question, you know, going back into the classroom now, has been, you know, quite an adjustment because I haven't been out for sort of 18 months or so and getting back into to teaching again. And we've done a lot of work around kind of two strands to our teaching and learning to improve. So we've looked at improving subject knowledge, and we've used it's like a Tom Sherrington version of kind of these walkthroughs to improve our instructional coaching to also improve some of the kind of pedagogy in the classroom. And this next question that I'm going to talk about now is one of my targets. So, you know, I'm hoping I've been leading this from the front in the sense that I have a coach within the science department who comes in and watches my lessons or sections of my lessons and then gives me some really concrete, actionable feedback based on kind of instructional coaching, step lab kind of approaches, which come from Tom Sherrington and Doug Lamov. And you know what a kind of huge fan I am of Doug's work. So one of my targets is to kind of scaffold better and look around the I do, we do, you do model. So can you tell us a little bit about that model and how teachers can transition students through these phases effectively?
Yeah, totally. Are you actually using StepLab, the app?
Yes.
Oh, great. How are you finding it?
Really good. Yeah, I mean, we need to get a little bit more coverage in terms of the number of teachers that are using it because they've had the choice this year of doing a subject knowledge enhancement, an MPQ qualification, professional qualification, and then also, you know, to improve your kind of delivering the classroom instructional coaching. And so not everybody's engaged with it yet, but we have paid extra for next year to get everybody on board with some clear kind of focus there. But I thought it was important to kind of try it myself and try and lead from the front. And Adele, who won't be listening because, you know, surely my own teachers don't listen to me again in the evenings and the weekends. But if she was, you know, it's been really good to kind of get her feedback on some practice. And, you know, it's really enthused me and encouraged me and got me kind of thinking back about teaching and learning.
That's great, Phil. And I think, you know, leading from the front as you are, you know, being vulnerable and actually going through the processes that you're expecting your teachers to go through themselves is an awesome way to go. And I'm also excited to hear that you're using StepLab because I've been checking it out recently and I think it's, you know, a super powerful tool. And I think what Josh Goodrich and Pez McRae, Harry Fletcher Wood and the team have done is awesome. I'm looking forward to going to their conference later on this year too. Back to your question though, about I do, we do, you do. Essentially, the way that I kind of think about this is, as a teacher, we have, hopefully, a collection of knowledge and knowledge structures in our head, And it's our job to try to support our students to acquire and build essentially those knowledge structures that we have. Now, unfortunately, we can't just kind of download them into our students. So what we need to do is we need to provide a structured process by which those structures can make their way from our minds to those of our learners. And this is why the I do, we do, you do model is so practical and helpful. It's because it provides a way to move from more to less structure and to gradually release the responsibility of that kind of construct building to our students. So in terms of the I do, this is really the most explicit part, and this is where the kind of explicit of explicit instruction comes in. And it's where we reveal and we make really clear to our students the mental model of the content that we have that we're trying to convey to them. So we do this essentially by modeling the process or making it clear to them. We do it with things such as examples and non-examples, and we do it with providing templates as well, ideally. So for example, just last night I was working with a student that he had a test today, and we were looking at financial mathematics, and he was really struggling and he was kind of getting in the weeds with the maths a bit, and he was struggling to work out exactly what he was meant to be doing on the different questions. And I said, you know, I tried to convey what happens in my head when I approach one of these questions. And this one of the big challenges of kind of conveying that mental model is that we as teachers have often been doing this stuff for many, many years. So we fall prey to what's called the curse of knowledge, and we actually find it hard to identify the thought processes that our brains are going through because they've become completely automatized. They're automated, they're subconscious, they're unconscious for us, and we just do this stuff automatically. But as I reflected, I thought, well, the first thing I actually do with these financial questions is I identify what the financial situation is. You know, is it compound interest? Is it reducing balance depreciation? That's the first step, and that absolutely needs to come first. And then the second thing I do after that is I look at the question. I really try to look what it's asking for. Is it asking for the size of the payment? Is it asking for the duration of the loan? Is it asking for the size of the final payment? And things like that. So I identified that these are the two things, the two steps that I take. And so I just explicitly communicated to this student. I said, all right, there's two steps I take when I look at any new question in finance. Step one is to identify the financial situation. Now, here's a template of the 10 financial situations that you've been taught in your knowledge organizer. So I want you to literally look at this question, take your finger and point to the financial situation. After that, the next step is to identify what the financial situation is looking for. So, you know, turn over three pages in your knowledge organizer, and I want you to have a look at the list of the questions we could ask you and identify which type of question you've been asked. So that's the kind of explicit part. That's a one-on-one example. You know, it's a similar process in the classroom, but that one's just kind of top of mind for me because it happened yesterday with a student. So that's the I do, the modeling. The we do is where you step your students through the same thought process that you go through yourself. So in the I do, I've said, these are the steps that I take, and I might actually model that. And I did, in fact, model it for the student on a couple of questions. The we do, you kind of scaffold them through the same thought process. So what that looks like is you can either go use a more scaffolded approach. So in this case, I could say, okay, here's a new question. I want you to look at this question, and I want you to tell me what type of financial situation this is. Scaffolding for step one. And then you can say, okay, you've done that. Step two, what's the question asking for? So that's kind of the first level of the we do. But then as you've done that a few times and students get used to the questions that they should be asking themselves, you can step back to a higher level of metacognition. And instead of asking the student, what is the first step? Instead of asking the student what's the financial situation that we're looking at here, you can ask, what is the first question I would ask you when you look at this question? And then you're actually getting them to retrieve even more information, and they have to retrieve the question, and then they need to answer the question. And you kind of fade that guidance over time so that the student gets to the point where they know what question they need to ask themselves, they know how to answer that question, and they can anticipate the following sequences of questions. So that's the we do. We kind of step the student through that thinking process. And once you've modeled it in the I do, once you step them through that thinking process, with the We Do, then you can hand over to students that kind of independent practice time for the You Do. For the You Do, you essentially just start with similar problems to the kind of problems they've been facing. You make sure that there's a lot of problems for them to practice. You know, some people call it slop or shed loads of practice, or I don't know if you swear on this show, but I'm sure you can imagine what the S could stand for.
Yeah, you can. Carry on.
And then ideally and optimally, you want to also space that practice. So give the students the opportunity to not only practice today, that skill, but practice it tomorrow, practice it in 3 days, practice in a week, 2 weeks, a month, etc., so that they actually retain that information for the long term.
Brilliant, thank you. And in terms of the swearing on the show, we never used to, Ollie, until we invited Mark McCourt on, but he was making such great points that he really did need the swearing for emphasis on some of the edgy myths that he was exploring. So we're just fine with that now. And that's just so interesting because I'm working in that class that we're talking about whilst having instructional coaching and the step-level approach. I'm also having an ECT, you know, the career teacher within the class as well. So he's kind of working with me. And one of the things that we're working on is this, as I said before, the I Do, We Do, You Do. But what we're finding is that a lot of the students are not prepared to struggle at the point of You Do. And we are providing perhaps, you know, obviously naturally support, but perhaps too much support at that level and not being able to transition very well from the kind of We Do to the You Do for the majority of students. It's very easy for them to say, I don't get it. I'm not sure what you're talking about. Can we go through another example, etc.? So we're not quite getting to the effective slop yet. And, you know, I've kind of mentioned to him that perhaps we could take a step back and just see whether there is that kind of natural struggle that leads to, hopefully, that retrieval that you were talking about and those mental models being created and actually seeing a little bit of success will kind of be self-fulfilling and they can push themselves forward. So, you know, is it a difficult transition between, I mean, the I Do and the We Do is probably a reasonably straightforward transition, but between the We Do and the You Do, is that the most difficult transition? I mean, obviously it depends on the class and the learners.
I guess probably the most common thing I see. So my first book was Cognitive Load Theory in Action. And in writing that book, I did a really, really deep dive into worked examples, which is essentially what we're talking about most of the time when we're talking about the I Do and also the We Do. The two key principles behind effective worked examples are structure and persist. Structure means structure the worked example in such a way that it's really clear what the key steps are, that there's no kind of distracting information, that there's no replication of information. We're avoiding a lot of things like split attention, transience, and redundancy and things like that. So that's structure, ensuring clarity. And another point I wanted to make on that I Do is, and kind of related to structure, is it's really valuable to provide students with kind of knowledge maps or flow charts, things like that, decision trees. So you explicitly make the kind of decision-making process explicit to students rather than them trying to construct that decision tree for themselves based upon a series of instructional experiences. And in the book Tools of Teacher, I show quite a few of those kind of decision trees and knowledge maps and go through how that can be helpful. So that's a couple of points on structure. But the other one is persist. So one of the biggest issues with worked examples is that the temptation for us to not do enough of them. So if I'm working with students who are struggling with a concept, I will often do a couple of I Do's, but We Do's, I could do up to 10 or more. This is especially if we're in like small group instruction, but as a class, we could do 10 or more We Do's just to scaffold students towards that practice. So I would say that ideally the transition from the We Do to the independent practice isn't actually an easy one. It isn't actually a hard one. And in fact, it should come at the point where students are going, okay, sir, I get it. You don't need to tell me anymore. Let me do some by myself. So they should actually be kind of asking for it. It would be my sense that if students are not at that point, it's probably not the right time to hand it over to them as yet.
Brilliant. Thank you. That's a really good point. And I'll definitely look into that as I move into next term. Okay, let's get into chapter two. And we're talking about my favorite topic, which is behavior. Now, you've had some iconic episodes, Ollie, on the podcast on behavior. Particular favorites were Bill Rogers. How long ago was that one now?
Oh, couldn't tell you, mate. A couple of years. It was at least 3 years, I'd say, because I had him in my lounge room and it was two houses ago, and that was at least 3 years ago.
Wow. I mean, it's funny how you kind of, you know, obviously the listener associates that with a particular time, so I can kind of visualize running down the beach, which it sounds a lot more glamorous, Ollie, than it actually is, kind of wheezing slowly on the beach, but just, you know, extending the run to listen to that, because I mean, yeah. I was aware of the existence of Bill Rogers, but I hadn't necessarily read a lot of his work because, you know, I'm thinking when I started training to teach in England, there wasn't a great deal around, you know, effective behavior management, which is something that Tom Bennett kind of goes back to a lot. So that episode was absolutely superb. And I've incorporated a lot of what Bill Rogers said and then subsequently gone and bought the books into formulating behavior policies, which I've been able to write. And also, you know, when I get asked to go out and speak about the podcast and things, I do kind of do a section on behavior and I do reference a lot of what you talked to Bill Rogers about. So that was an iconic episode. And a more recent one is the one that you've done with Tom Bennett. Now, mm-hmm. I was fortunate enough to be with Tom Bennett last week because he came into our school to do some work with us, which he's doing. And obviously he's involved with the Research Ed movement. We're hosting a research event pretty soon. So obviously I've got a real interest in behavior. So on chapter two, on behavior. So first kind of general question, why is it important to have rules and regulations? And why is it important that we ask students to act in line with them?
Yeah. So essentially the goal of kind of rules and regulations is to safeguard rights, safeguards our students' rights. So, I mean, to hark back to Bill Rogers, who you just mentioned, and I totally agree, that guy is absolutely amazing. I actually much prefer to listen to him talk rather than read him, because I just find he's just so engaging in the way that he acts out the scenarios is so fantastic. But I digress. Anyway, the point of rules and the point of Bill Rogers on this topic is that they're to safeguard rights. And the rights that Bill emphasizes are the right to feel both physically and psychologically safe, the right to respect and fair treatment, and probably the most obvious one within schools, the right to learn. So students have rights. They have these rights, you know, safe right of safety, there's the right for respectful treatment, the right to learn. And it's our job as teachers and guardians to uphold those rights. And we do that through culture, but also through rules and regulations.
Brilliant. Thank you. So in terms of behavior, we often hear this, and you know, Tom Bennett is good on this topic, that particularly here in England, there wasn't a great deal of emphasis before things like the early career framework around, you know, teaching trainee teachers and new teachers how to, you know, improve their knowledge of behavior. So he talks a lot about behavior being a curriculum. And the report he did in 2017 talks about, you know, the kind of dearth of training around those areas. So if we're saying that behavior is a curriculum, and that's a topic that you've discussed on the podcast and in the book, how should it be taught and who should teach it?
Yeah, so for this kind of analogy, the first question for us to ask ourselves is, what is it, if something's a curriculum, what does that mean in a broad sense? In a broad sense, I would see a curriculum as meaning it contains kind of a clear scheme of work that lays out what needs to be mastered. So in a behavior curriculum, that might include a distinction between proactive and responsive behavior management. It might talk about some of the routines you should establish. It might contain a bunch of scripts that teachers might want to use and things like this. So a clear scheme of work that kind of lays out a developmental progression and a knowledge progression that we want teachers to really master. A curriculum should have built-in kind of assessments or at least checks for understanding to make sure that the learners are on track. And as we've just been talking about in instruction, a curriculum should include and have built-in the fading of guidance and opportunities for modeling and for independent practice. And also frequent revisiting of core ideas, which is something I've kind of emphasized, as well as reteaching. So that's a curriculum and kind of an instructional sequence, but that also applies to behavior management. In terms of who should teach it or communicate it, I guess whoever in the school is or in the organization is qualified to do so.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I mean, in terms of behavior as a curriculum, it definitely isn't or hasn't been taught as a curriculum in the sense that it's quite often, you know, something that you do at the beginning of the year. So you start at the beginning of the year. These are our expectations. These are the kind of things that we're going to be looking for this year. We do a big CPD session with all teachers and followed up by a set of assemblies with all students around. These are the expectations. And then we kind of leave it alone. And we only look, and as you said there, we look at kind of the reactive. And obviously I'm making huge generalizations, but that's something that, that you know, obviously I do on here. We tend to react to what we see as potential, you know, not perfect behavior, and then maybe readjust the behavior policy to kind of reflect that rather than spending a lot of time actively teaching the things that we want to see. And I think, you know, I think schools are doing a lot of stuff around routines, norms, expectations, particularly in unstructured times. But again, you know, I think back to kind of classroom practice, and I know there'll be people that will say that it's not the role of the teacher to kind of look at behavior management. It's the role of the teacher to teach the content and obviously look at the students' work. But there are opportunities, aren't there, within lessons to actively teach the kind of behaviors that you want. And a lot of the behaviors could be learning behaviors, couldn't they? So there's a little bit of a crossover there with the kind of curriculum and teaching and learning aspect of a school as well.
Yeah, definitely. And, you know, just then I was kind of speaking about it as being a curriculum for teachers, but you've well emphasized there, Phil, that it's a curriculum for students. We need to be as explicit about behavioral standards and expectations as we are about the content. And we need to go into a lesson with as much clarity around the behavioral expectations as we do around the expectations around the knowledge that our students are going to gain within the lesson. So I really appreciate you for emphasizing that there, Phil.
No, thank you. I mean, it's just like I said, it's such an interesting topic, and having, you know, you've had the pleasure to speak to a lot of people around that, and I like how you've kind of made that crossover with, you know, previous chapters, and there's a kind of seamless flow between that. You're not talking about behavior in a different way that you'd be talking about, you know, the I do, we do, you do model could equally, in some aspects, be transferable to a behavior conversation that you could have as well. So, I mean, I like the way that you've kind of brought all of that together to make that sort of golden thread through the book. So you talked there about scripts, and you know, I've had conversations. We've had Peps has been on the podcast, but I didn't actually interview him. But I had Harry Fletcher Wood on talking around scripts as well. So, you know, it's a very broad question: are scripts helpful? But what kind of scripts would be helpful in a behavior context? And you know, how can we go about writing those?
Yeah, excellent question. So, I guess the question is: how do we get to scripts? How do we kind of motivate scripts or understand why they might be useful? If we imagine a teacher in a classroom trying to deal with, and scripts are often most helpful in kind of reactive or responsive behavior management situations, but we imagine a teacher who's in a classroom, things are getting out of hand, or a student acts out in a way, says something racist or says something inappropriate or laughs at another student or something like that. What the teacher does in that moment, the way that they react, is absolutely crucial. It's probably some of the most crucial times for them to act in the most appropriate way, you know, that we can identify. But let's also think about the psychological state of the teacher at this time. So we're requiring the teacher to, it's kind of the most crucial time for the teacher to behave and respond appropriately, but it's also likely the time where the teacher is under the most stress and having the lowest working memory capacity to actually consciously plan and thoughtfully respond to the situation at hand. So what's going to come out of the teacher at this time? What's going to come out of them is whatever's automatic for them, whatever is kind of inbuilt and innate. And so what we need to make sure is that whatever is inbuilt and innate for the student at that point in time is an appropriate response. So this is the point of scripts. Scripts are a way to try to train teachers to have the unconscious and the automatic response that is most appropriate in the situation. A script isn't necessarily something that's imposed from someone else, like something that Phil Naylor wrote or Ollie Lovell wrote or Bill Rogers or Tom Bennett wrote. A script is simply a structured way to respond to a situation and a planned way to respond to a situation. And I think the most powerful scripts are actually the scripts that teachers write for themselves when they're kind of planning to react. And the best way to do that is to just run professional development for teachers, you know, list a whole heap of scenarios that are most likely to occur in the classroom and most likely to be distressing or challenging to deal with, and then to work in small groups to write and refine scripts. A script can be a sentence. It can be a few words, right? And then, to to refer to the research or the evidence around what's likely to be successful in scripts. So Bill Rogers talks about, you know, being descriptive, to identifying what's going on, being directive, making a request, and offering limited choice for the students. So using those kind of frameworks can be really helpful for writing the scripts, but then crucially, practicing them, because the scripts are no useful if they're not used. So they actually have to get to the point of automaticity so that teachers are automatically responding in these crucial situations with those most appropriate responses. So I think scripts are incredibly important and valuable. I think practicing scripts is incredibly important and valuable. And I think it's something that we would ideally focus much more time on in teacher education.
So that there, listener, is the reason that we got Ollie to come on the podcast. That is the best explanation that I've had. And I've been teaching for 22 years of the power of scripts. I was just thinking there as I was listening to you going through and talking about, you're absolutely right. It takes you a lifetime of experience to build up a response that you can automatically use in a certain situation that you've been in before. But what you're advocating there, and I think you're absolutely right, is the idea that you can prepare your own script for those particular times using that Bill Rogers model about, you know, having limited options particularly, and just use those in those times to make sure that you've got consistent, calm responses to, you know, potentially difficult situations. Because, you know, the job of teaching is challenging enough to the working memory and, you know, in terms of the content that they're delivering without having to think about, you know, 3, 4, 5 different responses to potential misbehaviors within a classroom. So I think that is really, really powerful and a great explanation of why scripts are really, really helpful. Thank you.
Thanks, Phil. And building on something you said there about it taking often a lifetime to build up, that's definitely true. But also the danger of that is that if we don't kind of catch teachers early in their careers and help them to consciously build productive scripts, the risk is that they'll compound their unproductive scripts out of just habit. Right, and they'll actually form these habits about ways of responding to situations that may be unproductive and that then need to be broken and replaced with new scripts. And that's an even bigger challenge than just implanting productive scripts in the first place, which is why I think initial teacher education, the first couple of years of teaching, are absolutely crucial times to help to give teachers the tools to respond effectively.
Yep, couldn't agree more. And you think to, you know, a kind of a widespread practice when I started teaching around behavior management was, right, you know, teacher X is particularly good at behavior management, go and watch teacher X. Well, of course, you go and watch teacher X and you don't see any misbehavior or any issues. You see productive working relationships with no sanctions being applied. And you think, well, how am I ever going to get to the level where that is? And a lot of their knowledge that either they've built up over time, or, you know, some of it might have been eight, some of it might have been got from a book, I don't know. But there was nothing there for you to kind of say, right, this is how I'd respond in those situations, which is, you know, where something around the step lab approach and, you know, the instructional coaching and that vulnerability you talked about before is kind of opening up to saying, right, these are things that I could improve on, and these are the mechanisms I'm going to use to try and do that. And perhaps these are the scripts that I'm going to use as well. Because you're right, you know, I might have scripts after 22 years, and I'm not saying that they're the right scripts, but how is the ECT working alongside me supposed to delve into, you know, 22 years of different, of the number of times you've been in that situation, and then apply that himself? Or, like you said, or unlearn the things that I am now teaching him. So you're absolutely right about that. It's really important. Okay, right. So we're going to get into routines, if that's okay, Ollie.
Sounds good.
Right. So in terms of routines, and this is something that I don't know how, and obviously thank you for doing this today when I know that you yourself getting over COVID. And, you know, obviously over here in the UK, we are certainly functioning normally in terms of schooling. So one of the hangovers from the pandemic in terms of, you know, behavior, which we're talking about in this topic, is a lot of schools have adopted routines where perhaps they didn't see the need for them and have subsequently continued to use them. So, you know, I'm a huge fan of Doug Lemov, and, you know, obviously I've spoken to him a couple of times about Teach Like a Champion, and I've been the teacher that's practicing giving out books, you know, timing how quickly I can get books back in. And, you know, it pays off, doesn't it? It pays off. Just to go on a side note, it pays off. I mean, we've had a couple of incidents and issues where, I don't know, the students have been down for a talk by a university, a science talk, and they've come back right a minute before the bell. And all I say is, right, so year seven, we're going to do our packing away routine now, and it, boom, done, in 1 minute, and they're off the break, so they can see the advantage of it. But what I'm coming round to is that routines have now sort of really taken off, certainly with regards to behaviour here in the UK. So what roles do routines play? And what's a good way to kind of develop a routine, and what are they useful for?
Yeah, so in the classroom, we really want to maximize the time available for learning, but we don't also only want to maximize the time available for learning. We also want to maximize the cognitive space and the cognitive resources for learning. So what is a routine? Well, a routine is essentially a habit for the whole class. And what's a habit? Well, a habit is just a kind of cue, action, reward sequence, or just a habitual action that you take that you do without even thinking about, right? So if we can turn some sort of activity, like you've just emphasized there, Phil, packing away your books and packing away all the equipment in the class, into something that is habitual for students, then suddenly we have more time in the classroom, but our students also have more cognitive capacity because they're not spending time thinking about, okay, who's going to go to the bookshelf first, which colored eraser am I going to get today, who's going to get an eraser, do I need to get there first, who am I going to shove or be shoved by, and all those kinds of things. They don't need to think about all those things. It's all just automatic. And, you know, it might be writing down the learning intention if that's something you do in your school. It might be opening your book. It might be entering silently and starting the do now, anything like that. But when we get these routines happening, we open up more time for learning, and we also open up more cognitive space for learning. In terms of how to develop them, we develop them in the same way as we develop everything. We specify exactly what it's looks like. We model what it's going to look like. We scaffold students to do it the way we want it to look like. And then we reinforce it till it becomes automatic, and we revisit it over time.
Brilliant. Thank you. And I mean, I think Tom Bennett was really good on this. And I've nicked a quote of his to put into the book about this, where he talks about, you know, and he does it in the way that Tom always does. And he says, you know, people say when you're trying to put routines into the classroom, I'm paraphrasing Tom, so I will cut this out if necessary. But he said, you know, you're a monster, Bennett. You know, you're trying to, you know, make students and children into robots. And he said, no, I'm trying to free up the capacity. I'm trying to make sure that the working memory is free, so that they don't think about where to hang up the coat, where to put the chairs, where to put the pens, pencils, rules, etc. Their minds are free and open to learn about all the wonders of science, you know, the kings and queens of England in history, whatever it might be. And, you know, that's the kind of importance of it, isn't it? That it's making things a lot easier when you're reducing the number of decisions that you've got to make when you come into a classroom, to free you up to be able to kind of essentially do what you're there for. So I think that's really, really important.
Just a
reminder for listeners. So we're talking to Ollie Lovell, and we're talking about tools for teachers, how to teach, lead, and learn like the world's best educators. And it's a John Catt book. Okay, Ollie, last section. So as the listener will know, we like to keep it to around about an hour, and we just give you kind of whetting your appetite for the book. So we're hoping that listeners can go straight in and get the book. And you know, if they go and listen to your podcast, there might be some deals on there, Ollie, might there, for some vouchers and things like that.
There is indeed.
Excellent. Excellent. So we won't put it on here. We'll signpost everybody to ERRR and make sure that you listen to that as well. But if we just get into the last chapter that we're going to cover, which is chapter 3, and we're talking about students' motivation. So again, like I said, we've had Peps on, we've had Harry Fletcher Wood on, who are good on these topics, and I know you've spoken to them and others. So tell us a little bit about how the listeners can increase their students' motivation.
Yeah, well, first I do want to acknowledge both Peps McRae and Harry Fletcher Wood as the source of most of these ideas. They both have their own models of motivation for students, or motivating students. And the model that I've developed is essentially a rearrangement of what they've both taught me over a number of years, because they're real leading lights in this space. But the framework that I use is that to motivate students, we need to do three key things. We need to show that the actions and the behavior that is desirable is valuable to them. We need to show that it's normal, and we need to make it easy. So in terms of showing it's valuable, that's just convincing students that it's actually worth their time. In terms of showing that it's normal, we're kind of leveraging social norms and helping to leverage their need to belong to motivate their actions. And in terms of making it easy, we're just reducing the cost, because if something's too hard for students, they're simply not going to engage with it, irrespective of how valuable and normal it might be. So in terms, there's a whole heap of things that we can do in terms of making it, showing it's valuable, showing it's normal, and making it easy. But to give you a few examples, to show that it's valuable, the most simple thing to do is just to explain that it's valuable. You know, give students reasons why doing their homework tonight is going to be beneficial, or why doing a bit of practice every day is going to be beneficial versus doing it all in one go. And you can go into the science of learning on that if you want. But that idea of explain it is really helpful. Building on that kind of idea of explanation is the idea of rationale elaboration. So this is actually getting a student to explain to another student why something's valuable. And something I love here that a lot of schools leverage well is kind of using a buddy system. So getting older students, teaching older students good study habits or something, and then getting them to teach that to younger students, because the act of explaining something actually makes you more convinced it's a good idea yourself. Another thing we can do is kind of simulate a problem that students are likely to face. So a good example that Harry Fletcher Wood gives here is if we want our students to get better at organizing their learning resources, we could ask them to, on relatively regular occasions, to actually bring out that resource from 3 weeks ago, or bring out that paper on osmosis from 3 lessons ago, and things like that. And what that does is that helps them to realize that, oh, I've actually got a problem here with my organization because I can't find these things that the teacher keeps on asking me for. So simulating a problem can also show to students that it's valuable. And probably there's a bunch of other ideas, but I'll just finish on this one in terms of showing it's valuable. It's just simply repeating that it's valuable. When students hear messages over and over again, they have a tendency to believe that they're more valuable than if they hear them less frequently. And there's actually been a bunch of really interesting psychological research that says if people hear the same message from the same politician lots of times, they actually attribute it to a more credible source than if they hear it from a number of sources, but not as many times. So repetition is incredibly valuable when showing that something is valuable. Showing it's normal is just, like I said, leveraging those social norms. And there's a few things we can do here. We can speak as if the thing's normal. So a kind of phrase I often start the year with a new class is, students in my classes always work hard and do their best, right? So when I say that, I'm essentially saying there is a norm in my classroom and this is what it looks like. So you can speak as if the norm's in place. And another one that I really like is highlighting a trend. So I did this last term when I kind of really wanted to change some of the homework behaviors in my class. And what I did was I just found a couple of weeks in which a couple more students handed in their homework, and then I highlighted that trend. I said, oh, I spoke to you all a couple of weeks ago about the importance of homework and when we set some goals as a class. And I've noticed since then that more and more students every week have handed in their homework. This is a fantastic trend. Let's keep it up. So when you do that, you're just picking kind of a slight tweak in the right direction and you're jumping on it and highlighting it as if it is a norm, whether it is or it isn't. Ideally, it will be. So you're being genuine. And that can help to students to want to jump on that bandwagon. And another one, a third one in terms of showing it's normal is really making the normal or the productive behavior visible to students. So you can do this with like weekly gratitudes, students of the week, highlighting when students are doing great things. I used to do a student of the week. I used to give students lollies when they and make it a real public thing when students really handed in homework where they'd taken all the steps that I'd specified, like do all the questions, check your answers clearly, redo the questions you struggle with and things like that. But kind of a word of warning around highlighting things is we want to make sure that we don't highlight a norm that's unproductive. So if you're going to ask a question to your class like, how many of you did your homework over the weekend? Make sure you do not ask that question if a minority of students in the class did do their homework. Because if you say, how many of you did your homework in the class over the weekend? 2 out of 20 students put their hands up. Every kid is looking around and going, oh, okay. Well, I'm just gonna be normal and not do my homework because it looks like no one in this class does their homework. So that's something to be really, really careful of. And the third idea, after show it's valuable, the first idea, show it's normal, the second one, the third one is make it easy. We just need to reduce the barriers for students to participate. So this is, the best thing here is just to really teach really well so that our students have success right from the outset. Be really explicit about our expectations, show what needs to be done. We can make the first step easy, like making the first few questions in the homework easy. And, we can also help students and highlight to them that they can do it through positive talk. So you can say things like, oh, you know, Phil, last lesson you focused for full 40 out of 50 minutes. That was absolutely incredible. And I know you could do that again today. So just things like that and reinforcing those positive messages. Or even if a student's been off task or they're off task, going up to them saying, oh, Harry, last 5 minutes have been fantastic work. I see you're a little bit distracted now, but let's keep up that fantastic focus. That was really great. Things like that, making it easy, emphasizing they can do it, can be really valuable too.
Brilliant, brilliant. Great answer. Thank you very much. Thanks, Ollie. So we're going to get into talking about habits. Now, this seems to have, again, taken off. I mean, obviously, Harry Fletcher Wood's book last year was hugely influential on me. And I said that to him, both professionally and personally, I've got to say, Ollie, in terms of, you know, I started thinking about how you could apply some of those principles more widely to, your everyday life. So, you know, I went on and kind of changed a few things, dietary things, and I changed a few things exercise-wise, and I've kind of stuck to those. So the reason I'm sharing that is
Give us an example. I'm curious.
Right. So, okay. So all the way through the winter, I was able to change the pattern of the day. So I went to bed at 9 in the evening and I woke up at 5 in the morning. And it wasn't a case of like dragging myself out of bed. I was fine because I had the 8 hours sleep, but it was a productive time where I could do a few things. So I did all of these things. I had the running kit ready to go by the door. So easy, nice and easy. Mm. It was there ready to go. Went out, did that, listened to podcasts while I was out running because I thought, well, that's quite professionally, quite stimulating and quite useful as well. So it was kind of that attractive. So it's that kind of East model I was looking at. The social bit of it was that, you know, I kind of updated. I thought I'm going to try and, I mean, it's bad to say on the podcast, I try and update more often in terms of Twitter, LinkedIn, yeah, all of those kind of things and interact with people a little bit more. So I did that every single morning, knowing that, you know, most people wake up, flick through Twitter, flick through whatever it is in the socials and kind of interact. And I saw more kind of engagement, more interaction, more guests wanted to come through that way. And then when I'd done that, then it was right straight into work because previously I'd had some kind of regime where I went to the gym in the morning. Now that's quite difficult to do, Ollie, in terms of right the amount of stuff you've got to take to make sure that you're ready for the day because, you know, we've all got complex lives, haven't we? So we're having to get gym kit ready, take it to school, get changed at school, get the gym kit in the bag, put the suit on, go and do the day's work, take it back, wash it, come back around. It was all quite too complicated. But Harry kind of started thinking about, right, habits that are easy, attractive, and that kind of social pressure of doing it as well, of reminding that I was going to do an update every morning and I knew that someone would check or someone would interact with it. So it kind of kept me in check with it. And I kept it all the way up through the winter. Now I've changed it again for the summer because you've got the lighter evenings now. So I can do some of that sort of stuff in the evening and still have that little bit more time. But I thought it was really, really beneficial in terms of my own life. I thought, well, we can definitely apply this, can't we, to the classroom as well. So another book, I think, I don't know if whether you've seen it, is Atomic Habits. Seems to be quite popular in terms of a book that a lot of teachers have read. So how important are these habits and how can we help students to turn productive learning behaviors into habits?
Yeah, I think first of all, great story, Phil. Love that. Really resonated with your excitement around developing that routine, and it is just so positive and empowering when you make a change in your life like that and you feel like you're making great progress, and especially when it's around exercise because it just makes your whole day feel better, doesn't it? So that's thanks for sharing that story. It's really great to hear. And in terms of habits, well, Peps McRae has a great model on this. He talks about motivation as a cost benefit analysis. So the benefit is the kind of things that we've just been talking about in terms of what's the actual value you get out of it. What's the endorphins you get through your run? What's the social capital you get from posting it on your socials and things like that? That's the benefits. But motivation has this other side, which is the cost. And cost is the effort you need to put in to get that reward. So what habits are? They're a way to reduce the cost. And this is because in the same way as routines are habits for the class, by making things automatic, we don't actually need to think about it and the cost becomes essentially nil. It's simply the time required to do the task. So that's why habits are so valuable. So whether it be habit to start your homework or to go for a run in the morning or whatever it is, establishing those habits reduces the cost. In terms of how they're formed, well, as I mentioned before, they're essentially a cue, a routine, and a reward. And so what you just want to make sure you do is you make the clue really concrete and clear. So for you, it's like, as soon as I get up, I'm going to put on my runners and my running kit. That's the cue. In the classroom, you want to make clues really clear and ideally multimodal. So it might be something you say, a movement you make, and things like that to combine to make the clue really distinct. And also distinct from other cues that you use. The routine, we just need to make sure it's well specified. So for you, it might be running and listening to a podcast. That's pretty simple. Or, you know, run and touch this bridge or this jetty or wherever it might be and come back. That's a very clear, well specified routine. And the reward is just, you know, what's the good feelings you get at the end. And so if you can line all those things up, the cue, making it clear where and how to start, the routine exactly making it clear to students what they're expected to do, and the reward actually make it fun or give them some praise at the end or help them reflect and feel proud about their achievement, then we're likely to be on the right track to establishing those habits as long as we reinforce that sufficiently over time as well.
Yeah, great stuff. Great stuff. Right. So one of the habits that we've got here, like I said, is we keep it to an hour. So we're on 58. We're doing really, really well here. So just a reminder again for listeners. So we're talking to Ollie Lovell about tools for teachers, how to teach, lead, and learn like the world's best educators. So obviously, Ollie, you're going to be doing the podcast as well. So just tell the listeners a little bit more about if they haven't, and then goodness knows that surely they've gone to ERRR before they've come here. I mean, that is the order, listener. Surely you're going to do that. But if you haven't, where can they find out more about you in terms of your website? I know you've got subscribers get extra every month in terms of things that you provide for them. So tell us a little bit more about that and where they can find the book. And if you don't mind, can you tell us a little bit about where you're going to take the podcast and everything else that you're doing next?
Sure. Lots of questions. I'll do my best in the minute and a half that we have left, or one minute
now.
You
can go over slightly. It's almost like you said then there. You know, you said about habits. It's like this is the kind of the person who listens to this podcast, presumably, is somebody who thinks, right, well, here's a nice hour of CPD that I get. So they kind of know what they're going to expect. It's going to land on a Monday. It's going to be roughly an hour. He's going to be talking to an educator about the book. He's going to be asking a certain questions about these, and he's going to put himself in a position. So they kind of, it's the habit for the listener. That's for these videos. But you, as a special guest, can go as long as you want on this one.
Love it. Thanks, Phil. All right. Here's the half-hour answer. No joking. ERRR podcast, you can find it anywhere where you get your podcasts. If you just search Education Research Reading Room or Ollie Lovell, O-L-L-I-E Lovell, L-O-V-E-L-L, you should be able to find it. The book, yeah, there's some codes for discounts on all John Catt books in the podcast. There's 60, I think. Tomorrow I'll be I'm a day late, actually, speaking of habits, Phil, but tomorrow I'll be releasing, I think, the 66th episode of the podcast. So there's a large backlog to get through. If you're keen to hear Dylan William, Daniel Willingham, Daisy Christodoulou, John Hattie, I don't know, we've had lots of fantastic people on. You asked me lots of questions in a row, Phil. I'm trying to remember what else you wanted to know.
Just about where you're going to take the podcast next in terms of, because obviously I think that a lot of people would be interested in the subscriber benefits, for example, and people who, you know, get the transcripts through, don't they, and get extra resources. Tell us a little bit about that.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. If people can sign up for as little as a dollar or a pound per month, and then they get an interactive transcript where you can just kind of search for a word. So if you're listening to this one, you could search for habits. And the section on habits would come up, and you could just click and listen back from there. And I also write a summary for patrons every month that kind of really summarizes, in hopefully really clear terms, what people get out of it. And you know, people seem to get value. I think I've got about 450 people supporting the podcast now, which is absolutely fantastic. It helps it to be sustainable, but also I guess communicates the value of those summaries, which is really. Before that, no one was supporting the podcast, but after that, a lot of people signed up and people stick around. So that's a real great indication that they do get a lot of value out of that. And in terms of where the podcast is going, I just plan to keep on keeping on, Phil, because I love it. Like you, it's a discipline every month to actually read at a deep level a book on education that's, you know, at the forefront and really interesting, or maybe a classic from education. And then it's an absolute privilege to get to speak to the author and really interrogate them in a nice way, of course, about their ideas and their developments and their initiatives, and to be able to share those great insights with an audience. So I have no plans for kind of changing the format or the template at all. Something that is exciting is that as long as I don't get COVID for a third time and nothing untoward happens, I do plan to actually be in the UK in the middle of this year, and I have a few school visits planned, and I hope to speak to a few school leaders of some prominent educational institutions in your part of the world, Phil. So that's a bit of a new format. Hopefully, will be three episodes taking that format, and I'm really excited about those ones.
Brilliant. That's really exciting. Great stuff. Great stuff. Well, again, just to kind of round it off. So thank you for everything that you did into the podcast. As you may or may not be aware, it was at the end of the book. So obviously we are finishing in July. I mean, I've done 3 and a bit years of pretty much, well, it starts off every week and it went to every couple of weeks and it's there or thereabouts now. But I just feel as if I'm going to try and kind of sit back and listen to podcasts, obviously top of the list, ERRR, do a little bit more writing and kind of get stuck into leading on teaching and learning within schools. So be more of a consumer rather than a producer. But thanks for everything. Thanks for your support over the time. And, you know, I'm a regular listener, really enjoy the podcast, love the book. So thank you for coming on today, Ollie. Really, really appreciate your time.
Thanks so much, Phil. Thanks for all your work as well. It's been an absolute pleasure to be on your podcast. You've been a great host.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.